This is Business of Home. I'm your host, Dennis Scully. Every week, I'll be talking to leaders and innovators from all corners of the home industry. My guest this week is Jim Druckmann, the president and CEO of the New York Design Center. Jim grew up in the furniture industry. As a young man, he followed his father into the family distribution business and learned the trade. Then, in the 1990s, he took over at 200 Lex and began transforming the building into the high-end, design-driven destination it is today. We spoke about how showrooms and design centers need to keep offering designers a reason to come shopping, what the lasting effects of COVID might be, and why the biggest challenge the industry faces has nothing to do with pricing or transparency, and everything to do with educating the public on the value of great design. This podcast is sponsored by The Shade Store. The Shade Store offers designers everywhere a simplified resource for premium, handcrafted custom window treatments. With a team of dedicated design consultants available to guide you through the material and product selection process, measure and install professionals to ensure the perfect fit, and more than 95 showrooms nationwide, The Shade Store has everything you need to design the most beautiful shades, blinds, and drapery for your clients. Designers receive special discounts and trade-exclusive access to The Shade Store's industry-leading COM program, which gives you the freedom to use the fabrics and trims you want on Roman shades, drapery, and cornices. Combined with The Shade Store's extensive collection of more than 1,300 in-stock materials, the creative possibilities are virtually endless. The Shade Store. Custom. Made simple. Visit theshadestore.com/trade today to learn more. A new digital baseline has been set in home furnishings as everyone is moving online. One thing is clear. You have to have your digital game together. But how are interior designers and trade brands supposed to compete against the tech giants and e-tailers gobbling up the market? Sidedoor has built a solution. For designers, it's a new way to monetize your taste and to grow your own brand. For trade companies, it's a way to help designers show and sell more of your product. Everyone benefits. Sidedoor has a three-step plan to get designers out of the low-margin game and build a healthy new revenue stream. Request access at onsidedoor.com. And now, on with the show. Jim, I'm delighted that the 95th anniversary of the New York Design Center has finally brought us together here on air. After all the time we've spent together over the years, we finally get to sit down and have this conversation. So I'm so pleased to have you.
Well, I'm pleased to be here. I've always loved talking with you, Dennis, and I always respect all the podcasts you do. But I think that this was something so special that I was going to leave my ivory tower and come and talk.
Well, I appreciate you coming down from the tower to speak with me. I really appreciate it.
Not coming down, climbing up.
Well, thank you, and it's great to have you. And I want to explain for listeners who might not be familiar with what the New York Design Center is, and I can't imagine there are people who still don't yet know who Jim Druckmann is, but we're going to fill them in on you as well. So your life so overlaps with so much of the history of the furniture industry, and I want to get to that. Tell us a little bit about sort of you sort of growing up in the furniture business and ultimately not thinking you were going to stay in the furniture business, but getting pulled back in, as one often does with a family operation.
My grandfather started distributing furniture from Virginia, actually, Bassett Furniture, in 1923. I was a little young then to learn anything, but seriously. And then after World War II, my father went to work for his father. And he always used to tell me that he sold complete bedroom sets of furniture for $22. So I'm telling you this because I want now that I run a design center where you can buy a sofa for $22,000 in certain showrooms, I want you to see the breadth and scope of where my education comes from. Anyway, then I was determined to practice law. And after graduating from Wharton, I then went on to Columbia Law School, and I practiced law for a couple of years afterwards. And then my father came to me and said, you know, I've always wanted you to work with me, but now I need you. My mother was very ill, and he had a business partner who was leaving him, and so I really couldn't say no. And I used to describe working with my father as another graduate school, because he truly was the guru, I guess, certainly of the mass production furniture business, renowned not just in New York, but pretty much all over the country. I remember going to North Carolina with him when I first started working for him, and I found it fascinating that after hours, people would come to our hotel to meet with him, and there would be sometimes there'd be five groups at a time waiting. He was that respected.
Oh, my goodness.
In any case, if I can go now diverge to the history of the building, because otherwise I'll get too far forward.
Sure.
In 1891, when I was really young, there was no centralized furniture market at wholesale in the United States. In New York, then you had the center of everything. And so that's where they first rented space near where the New York Design Center is now. And they rented space and they ran wholesale furniture markets from 1891 through 1925. At that point, a group of the descendants of the 1891 people, by then including my grandfather and his brothers, all were involved in buying the land and building the building for the New York Design Center, which then was known as the New York Furniture Exchange. And they continued to run, they started and continued to run wholesale furniture markets in the building, a la High Point, I would say, from 1925 until the late 70s. They went through the Depression, managed to do it successfully, World War II, you name it. And the late 1970s, however, the Southern furniture manufacturers were no longer interested in exhibiting around the country. And when their leases were up, stopped doing that and forced everybody down to High Point, which then became even bigger. Anyway, to make a very long story a little shorter, by 1995, my father's Alzheimer's got the better of him. And so the board felt that I was the right person to take over, because during that time I had opened a showroom called Profiles in the Building. And so I learned the design trade. Not as a designer, but as a purveyor.
Right. So help me understand. It was interesting what you were saying earlier about the furniture companies and how New York used to be such a central market for so many of these furniture.
Certainly,
companies.
Well, it's still probably the largest market in the country, but it was central then because in 1891 the country hadn't really boomed further west.
Right.
And so at some point, and I don't know the year, the main national market shifted to Chicago. Now, we always maintained regional markets in New York. And we always also every Friday the New York Furniture Exchange then was a market day. And it was sort of like a club. And you knew, you know, you went to if you were a furniture buyer, you went to the showrooms that you did the business with. You'd probably be served lunch. Company called Kreb Stengel on the second floor had an open bar starting probably at 4 o'clock.
Probably a good stiff drink. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. So yeah. Anyway, that's how it was. And that was all basically regional. And so there were these regional markets by then, but High Point really supplanted them all. High Point was always good to me. So I don't like really to say this negatively, but they insisted that everybody come down to High Point, where they didn't have enough hotel rooms, they didn't have enough places to eat, and they didn't have enough cars to rent. But it didn't matter because we were a captive audience.
Right, right.
And it was great for business, I have to say.
Well, so and tell me what the building was and what the dynamic was with the building when you came in.
Okay, that's a good question. The building when I took over, certainly,
yeah,
which was 1995. Mm-hmm. It was a very nice building. If you remember the old commercial for rye bread, Levy's rye, when the guy behind the counter would say, cut the bread, make a sandwich, and taste it and say, makes a nice sandwich. Well, that's what the New York Design Center was in those days. It was nice. It was, we, Baker was, had been our, in the late, in 1982, it was the first national design tenant.
Okay.
My father, who I had the great, if you have, can't hear it in this, I had the greatest respect for, really never understood, in my opinion, the design business. He understood finance very well. He understood mass production furniture distribution better than anyone I ever know. He understood furniture retailing, even though he didn't do it himself. But he never quite understood the design, in my opinion, the design business, because when they first wanted to convert to a design center from this mass production, which was late 70s, Jerry Sonnen, who was the lawyer for everybody, I never knew how he got away with
sure,
it.
He represented
designers, showrooms,
yes.
I think the D&D building at one point.
Dongiev family.
Never understood how he did it, but Jerry Sonnen evidently came to my father with Brunswick, which in those days wasn't an important division of Kravit. It was
a big standalone.
It was the sure. It was the be all and end all of design.
Absolutely.
And Brunswick, and he offered my father, "I'll bring you Brunswick. I want a whole floor, and I want a year's free rent." My father looked at him like he was crazy, not understanding that bringing Brunswick in was bringing, in the old days when shopping centers were still important, bringing in Saks Fifth Avenue.
Yeah. Yeah.
As the anchor tenant. Despite that, we did well. And then when, in 1995, I determined that because we were sort of nice, we were a nice building with nice people, that we had to be more aggressive, and we also had to move to the forefront of product to make it interesting and make it more exciting. And so I started, that's what I started doing. And I would say we moved up 20 years, we were, who knows, we, you know, it was, we were 20 years behind the time, so we moved up 10 and 5.
Well, so, and at that point, what did you imagine it was going to take to make it more exciting? And what was really...
Oh, that's a very good question. Well, first of all, it needed, the furniture industry in America, as we sort of know it today, but certainly knew it then, had grown up after World War II, when anyone could sell anything they could make. Whatever price point or design level the factory fit into, they were trainloads of furniture. No such thing as a little truck. There were carloads of furniture going all over the country. And so the furniture companies in those days really didn't develop advertising or marketing to any great degree or to the degree they have since. And so they basically left the advertising to the dealers, to the furniture stores. Mm-hmm. And so my father and his associates who were then on our board really, for the most part, didn't understand the value of marketing and advertising. And I came in with the mantra. I said to the board, I said, "Look, you guys think I should do this. I'm happy to do it. I want to do it. But you're going to have to give me relatively free rein with marketing and advertising, because we are a marketplace. We are not necessarily a real estate project. We are enhancing and creating and developing a market in the design furniture industry. And so we have to start advertising. We have to start promoting. We have to start creating more events. We have to start doing all of those things so that we become our own, I don't know, everybody uses the word ecosystem. But anyway, we have to become our own system. We have to become our own market."
Yeah.
And so that I did everything that I could. I went to every single event. When I first started, I went to every single event that anybody even thought of or thought they might do, and talked to designers and talked to, obviously, prospective tenants. I still think that that's the, we're not geniuses, but the reason that we have a virtually full building, even through this pandemic, even through everything else, is that we're supportive of the marketplace for our tenants. We create opportunities for our tenants. Now, obviously, they have to do their own advertising. They have to do their own marketing themselves. And we can't do it for them, but we can market the marketplace. And that's the synthesis of all the things that I've been trying to do and have been successful at, I hope.
Well, and I want to stay with that, because you and I have talked about this in the past, the difference in the way you think about renting space to tenants and growing the industry at the same time versus simply being a real estate trust that's just trying to get the highest rent and right and whatever tenants you can get. You've always been very mindful of what a key role you play in sort of supporting this ecosystem, to go back to the word you were using earlier.
Right.
I mean, recognizing that there's a limited number of companies in this industry, and that if we don't support them, there'll be even fewer, and that won't be good for anyone in the business going forward.
Well, because we are, I would say, simply put, furniture people who happen to own a building, we probably have a different, even though I have other real estate investments and I'm actually very relatively active in real estate.
Yes.
In New York Design Center is a group, is owned and run by a group of people who are furniture people who happen to own a building. Whereas I would say a number of the other design centers, and this isn't to say anything detrimental because it isn't detrimental, are today owned by real estate people who don't have perhaps the same understanding of what you necessarily might need, or in terms of the marketing, you know, the marketing expense is not, that we do, is not normal to a just a building the way you're renting space out. And so I think that what's made us, I don't know if the word is special or different or whatever, is that we want the tenants to succeed. We want the marketplace to succeed. And once that happens, it turns from just a place for somebody to rent to show their product to a family. That's still not the right word, but I'm going to get the right word before.
Well, I think that is a way that your building is often described, and I think it's the way your tenants often talk about you. You are a very involved and very sort of hands-on landlord. Your office is in the building. You're often in the showrooms. I mean, I talk to some of your tenants and they say, "Oh, I better change that light bulb because Jim will notice that it's out."
Now that when I get into the building, I'm looking for no man, not no light bulbs. But yet, truthfully, that's true. That's the way I do. To do that.
Well, and I think that that's, I think that's what so many tenants appreciate so much about how you run that building. And I get it. It has to be a profit center too, of course.
Yes.
And it's a business, but that there's always this level of this sense that you are also there to help support their businesses. So many tenants have talked to me about advice you've given them or things you've encouraged them to do, or so many people have talked to me about how many years you came after them year after year,
saying, one day you're
going to be a tenant in my building. One day you're going to be in my building. And then 15 years later, Julian Chichester takes the space.
The best example is David Sutherland and Perennials, who I talked to about it for years. And all of a sudden, a couple of years ago, I met Anne on the street in Paris and said, "Anne, isn't it time?" And she said, "Yes, it might be." And so there you have it. And that has happened because, again, we have the philosophy that we are a long-term marketplace, rather than just being a building that you know you could rent out to dentists or something.
Well, and you referencing this story that you just told us about Gerald Sonnet and Brunchwig, and that was sort of too bad that never ultimately happened.
Right.
That would have been a great anchor tenant, and with that, I'm sure would have come others. When did some key tenants come on board at the New York Design Center that really was meaningful to the transition away from the furniture model that it had been to this design center that it became?
Specifically, I'm not sure I can tell you, but in general, what I tried to do was move to more high style and high end, not middle of the road lines. better lines, either better priced, better meaning higher, more decorator oriented kind of lines. And you know, I operate a showroom in the building, although I don't get there often enough. I have good people running it, profiles. And for years, I would bring in product that may or may not have sold, but had the right look and the right feel and it be in the right niche. I think I was the first one to heavily bring in California upholstery into New York from A. Rudin, who now have their own showroom and are a terrific manufacturer. But I thought that I should set an example for the rest of the building. And we still have unusual, really unusual lines. We profiles, we sell the Billy Haynes collection. We try to be at the height of fashion.
We're taking a quick break to tell you more about Sidedoor. Sidedoor is a game-changing new online sales tool. First, it's free for qualifying designers and trade brands. Second, instead of 1% to 3% affiliate programs, you earn an average of 30% on your favorite trade brands. Finally, instead of sending people to other sites to spend their money, Sidedoor gives designers a way to have them check out from you directly. Best of all, you don't have to deal with any of the fulfillment. The Sidedoor team places the order, coordinates the freight, and handles the customer service. It's an innovative online tool following the best practices of our industry and helping small businesses fight back against the e-commerce giants. Request access at onsidedoor.com. And now, back to the show. I wonder where your latest thinking is around traffic at the ground level. I know that you've tried with sort of retail hours sometimes in the past. What's the thinking there these days?
We used to be, although we didn't have that reputation, more closed to anyone but designers than any other building. I always felt that it was important to support the design trade. The only change has been over the years that instead of blocking people, if you remember the massive hulking black desk in the middle of the lobby,
yes.
we decided to allow the showrooms to sell to whom they like.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would not restrict anybody from coming into the building. I would say most of the showrooms, profiles included, are trade only. But the 10th floor with the antique dealers is not. We invite anybody to come and shop for antiques on the 10th floor. I would say, as far as the ground floor is concerned, I think that it's still basically a designer business. And I'm certainly I am certain that Sutherland is. I believe Dune is as well. Circa are expanding into the corner. As far as I know, and I mean, they don't seem to be advertising to the general public or anything. But as I said, our philosophy at the moment is we are a design building, but we don't dictate to the showrooms who they sell their design products to. What we do dictate to them is they have a certain high level of quality, I guess price point goes with a high level of quality.
Well, I ask in part because I know that some buildings have tried to figure out, was there a way to be open at extended hours or be more available to?
We have tried
to
open for extended hours, and they're you know, we used to open the 10th floor on Saturdays, and we had more security than we did customers. the building is open and operated on Saturdays, but it's all by appointment. There's no right now. Everything's by appointment, but in normal times, it's all been by appointment. I think the design industry has changed, and one of the things one has to think about is that the designers have more resources today that they use than they did when we and the other design buildings first started out, or whenever, I don't want to call it the olden days. I'm not that old, But I think you understand what I'm saying. Designers now feel that they can shop with clients at RH. They feel they can shop with clients everywhere. And so it's difficult to dictate, as we used to do, to the tenants, if they're predisposed to sell. I think really the one of the reasons I brought in somebody like Thomas O'Brien and his husband Dan and Timothy and other designers into the building is that I believe that they attract their clients, and they become almost the, you could sort of call it retail because they're bringing in their clients who they're selling to. And I've often said for years that the future of the industry might very well be that every showroom has resident designers whom they support, whom they share the profits with, and that way they have the ability to attract the public but not really sell to the public. They're selling through their own legitimate designers. Now, I know there are many retail stores that give a crash course to retail salespeople so they can say they've had design courses and things. That's not what I mean. I mean really, really professional, good designers having their own showrooms because so many of them now are having their own products.
Well, so you think that's a natural evolution for
Yes, I think I don't know how long it's going to take. I don't know because I've been talking about it for 20 years. But I do think it also helps the showroom. We used to have a showroom called KPS. Albert Pensis ran, and Albert Pensis had been the director of design for Bloomingdale's, and I think before that W&J Sloan's. And Albert never suffered during downturns in the market because at least a third of his business normally was done with his many clients. And so while other people who did not have their own clients, their businesses got worse in downturns, his never faltered. So if the regular business went down, he still had at least a third of his own, it was his own clients. And I thought I always thought that that was also part of a good model.
That's interesting. And you mentioned earlier about sort of RH and designers taking clients there in a sort of a much more comfortable way than they might have in the past. And what do you think, where when you think of the New York Design Center relative to that, do you think that you have to find ways to attract people in the same way that their sort of giant stores do, or what do you think the challenge is around that?
I think it's our job to promote the design industry first and foremost. So I think it's our job in our marketing to promote the use of interior designers. To me, there's no question. I think that a retail operation is to promote getting the traffic in and the customers in, and still they want to all attract the design business because it's a strong and good business. And so that's one of the reasons I think we have to be special. I mean, it's. I don't think you want 18 showrooms that look alike. And one of the things that I do selectively and sometimes not take people who want to come in, and I'm sure the other design buildings do the same, is that we want to make sure we have a proper mix, but we also have enough unusual things, enough special things to make it different. I mean, it's not to put down any retail operations, but and there's nobody who markets better in America than RH, in my opinion, and you can see by their success. But it's a different, it's a style that they are presenting to you to buy, whereas we're presenting options to designers who work with consumers to create their own styles.
Right. But it's interesting picking up on what you were saying earlier about designers in showrooms. I mean, Gary Friedman at RH thinks he's building the largest interior design firm in North America because he has all these designers. And I get where his thinking is.
I think he's done a mar. I think he's a genius. I think he's done a marvelous job.
No question, no question. And so, and he is a brilliant marketer. And you and I have often talked about interior designers haven't always had the best marketing behind them. And that's, and you and I share this frustration of people not sort of, right? Of sort of recognizing the importance or just even the pleasure. I remember you early on in your very first apartment had an interior designer and it changed.
Oh, yes, you remember. Can I tell the quick story?
Yes. Tell that story because I think
I was first married. I had just graduated law school, and I had actually very nice, very large one bedroom apartment that on a very inexpensive lease. And my law school roommate's wedding present to me was giving me the lease. You know, my father being in the furniture business and knowing, you know, all these retail stores, I said, to my wife, I'm sure we'll find some things and, you know, make it look nice. At which point my mother-in-law or then future mother-in-law came to visit and said, no, Nancy's not going to live like this. You have to have a nice place. And to her credit, she offered to purchase the furniture, so that made it a little easier at the time, to say the least. Anyway, well, I didn't know anything then about decorating. This is where I learned about interior design. I didn't know anything about decorating much. My mother had always had an interior decorator who was a family friend, who was very talented and published and everything else. But he was basically, they had grown up in Detroit together. And so I say to my mother-in-law at the time, Lucille, it's a wonderful gift for you to give us, but don't you think it would be better if you waited until we started a family and had children and moved to a larger place and then made it more worthwhile? And she, no, you've got to have it fixed up properly. So I don't know what to do. I call my mother and I say to my mother, what am I going to do? She said, well, tell her you want to wait till you have a family. I said, can't do that. So then my mother said, call Howard. The fellow's name was Howard Rothberg. I call Howard. First thing out of Howard's mouth is, didn't you tell her you wanted to wait until you had a family? That's just that one bedroom apartment. You don't need to. And I said, Howard, I don't want to have a fight before I'm even married with my mother-in-law. So she's willing to pay for it. Come help. So, okay, tell your wife to meet me or your fiance to meet me on Thursday. In the meantime, I'll go up and look at the place tomorrow. And Thursday, tell her to meet me at Scalamandre at 10 o'clock in the morning. Didn't realize in those days Scalamandre was certainly out of almost anyone's budget. I ever do. So Nancy meets Howard, and he arrives with a briefcase, and he opens the briefcase up. He has pictures of three sofas. Which style do you like? I think I want to put two small sofas facing each other in the living room. I like that style, says Nancy. Oh, I agree with you. And then, oh, by the way, I think we should have it was the 70s, so they were a really nice plexiglass-based coffee table in between. And he pulls out a picture. Do you like that, Nancy? Oh, it's beautiful. And it was. It was really great. Terrific. Okay. And then the salesman from Scalamandre came out. Howard, how are you? I'm fine, Joe. Joe, this is Nancy, and this is, you know, these are the kinds of colors we're thinking of, and you have anything new that you think I would like? And with that, he brings out a beautiful French chintz. Now, I didn't even know they had chintzes that weren't English, and it was beautiful. It was a beautiful fabric. Came in, he brought out only two or three different color waves, and Howard said, Nancy, which do you like? And she picked that, and he said, yes, you're right, that's the best one. And we'll order that, and I'll need this yardage for the two sofas is such and such, and then if he said, oh, and we'll probably, I think we'll do some matching curtains. So what do you have, anything that you think will work? And you know the Scalamandre's magnificent large silk checks.
Yes,
that's what he brings out, and of course they're beautiful, and. Oh, those are great. That's Nancy. What do you think? Oh, yeah, that's terrific. It'll go together beautifully. And then he says to the guy, and by the way, we'll take the fancy Scalamandre checked fabric for the curtains. And I'll call you next week with the yardage as soon as I get up there. And then he looks at Nancy and says, you know, Jim has those really utilitarian drawer units that are there now, We'll clean them up and add some more, and we'll make a whole wall of drawer units, and you find a bedspread you like, and we don't have to really spend any time or money in the bedroom. And okay, now this all took maybe 17 minutes, and I might be exaggerating. And I called it decorating 101 in 17 minutes. What I learned, and this will take us around back to the
Exactly,
show
exactly.
design, was what I learned was the value of a great salesperson, or even a good salesperson, because that salesperson knew, had done business with Howard before, knew his taste, knew not to waste his time with things that he wouldn't like. And so the synergy between the showroom salespeople, the showroom management, and the designer is probably paramount in our industry. And so I learned. That's how I learned about decorating.
Well, exactly. And I always remember you telling me that story, right? And that's really how you learned about the work that interior designers do, and the relationship that they have with their key salespeople, and how this sort of whole industry operates in that way.
To this day, I will tell a new tenant at the design center, don't come in if you're not, don't, I'll let you out of the lease if you can't find a good salesperson to start with. I won't make you sign it, or I'll let you out, because don't waste your time and mine. You're not going to succeed.
What do you see for design centers going forward, coming out of this COVID time? I feel like so much has changed, right? I mean,
I think
what do you
that
think?
during COVID, we've been very lucky to be in an industry that has survived with relative strength. That's the first thing. Post-COVID, I believe that, yes, you hear all and you read all the time that people have found it now easier to work from home. So I think the future has to be a combination where perhaps the traffic to the showroom might not be as often as it was, because people got used to doing things away from it. But it's still a necessary, and again, in the luxury business, in the design business, it's still necessary to, I shouldn't say justify the price, but perhaps I should say to warrant people using designers and getting products that are of the caliber and of the level that make designers want to buy them, to try to make their work unique, to try to make their work even more comfortable. So I believe that one will always need, especially at the upper end, showrooms, and it's up to the showroom owners as well as up to us as the design center owners. It's up to us to make sure that the shopping experience is pleasurable, so that they say when they do come, they say, you know, I should come here more often. No, again, I go back to RH. I mean, they've created, places people want to go with great restaurants, and it's just that it's their style they want to sell versus here, where we want to provide a place where the designer can have a choice and really show the value of being a designer.
Well, and I want to get into that even more deeply, because I think that's part of the challenge, and showing the value of being a designer, and showing the value of working with interior designers. Tell me more about your thinking
Well,
there.
first of all, I think people have to learn what the value is. They're not, it's I think today more than ever, there are more people who are more affluent than before, but they don't have necessarily a background in understanding interior design. And for the people who don't really understand that value, a place where you can feel comfortable and it's stylish, et cetera, where the store or the company are creating the style for you, is a very, very strong and good model. But those people also have to be taught the value of great design. And that's what's hard with the magazines, who are diminished, unfortunately, to a lot of extent, are the I think at the high end, still the appropriate place to see things, whether it's their digital versions or their print versions, we can debate. But I still believe in print, but it might be my age, not anything else, but the importance is that people have to educate the newly affluent who don't have a background in design on that value, and so they also have to be confident. I think certainly at retail, and probably to a large extent at in a different way in design, creating confidence in the consumer is the single most important thing. So we like to say that, you know, you're buying something at the New York Design Center, Mr. Designer, for your client, and we vetted the tenants. We hope not to give you a dud. We have to have different price points because you have clients with different budgets. But we have to give you multiple opportunities which are all vetted, whereas a chain of stores with similar merchandise in every store has done all that pre-vetting themselves. Mm-hmm. And also their job is simply to create the confidence in the consumer that their styling and their look and their production are essential to the consumer's life. And we just have to do it a little differently. The designers are as much the salespeople for the showrooms as the showroom personnel. And one of the biggest differences, and I would say one of the most thought about things from my point of view, is that the showroom personnel, as good as they aren't the closers of the sale. The designer has to close the sale. Now, if I told you the Howard story, of course, if you have a good salesperson, he'll close the sales, especially if the designer's there. But today, the designers aren't necessarily in the showrooms all the time. So that's another problem. The designer's got to be a closer for you, and you have to hope that he or she respects your showroom, your product, enough to close that sale for you. You know, there are a lot of people making sofas.
I know.
Back when I was in the, you like stories. So back when I was in the wholesale furniture business, Siemens was the major chain in New York for a long time. See Siemens first, if you remember the slogan.
Sure.
And I was a supplier to Siemens, and the buyer was of bedroom and dining furniture, which is what we were distributing for Bassett, was a guy named Carl Siemens, one of two brothers who then ran the business. And Carl Siemens, you'd go into his office and he would say, well, we've got 12 slots for dining room on the floor, and we got 302 offered to us lately. Why should we take yours? It's almost the same thing here at the design center. You know, why should we shop here? And what do you offer? And how do you offer it? And how do you protect us? That's why we try to be a full service design center. We have a furniture repair shop that's been in the same family for over 40 years, working out of our basement. And they're very qualified. We have a trucking company on the premises. We have a terrific cafe that we opened relatively recently.
Butterfield
yes. Market. And yeah. Now that we can have 25% indoor seating, and I'm getting vaccinated, we're in for coffee, Dennis.
We're taking a quick break to remind designers about the Shade Store's trade program with special discounts on custom window treatments. Designers enjoy unlimited free swatches and access to exclusive designer collections and COM on Roman shades, drapery, and cornices. The Shade Store also offers free professional measurements, installation options, and expert design advice whenever you need it. Let the Shade Store take care of the window treatments for you. The Shade Store. Custom made simple. Sign up for a trade account today at theshadestore.com/trade. And now, back to the show. What are the kinds of conversations that you're having with tenants these days? I mean, what are they saying about how they're thinking of not only this period, but how they're imagining coming out of this period? And what are they asking you about?
I will tell you that imagining coming out, a lot of them don't know the answers. I don't know the answer. Maybe I don't know that you know the answer. You might, because you speak to more people even than I do. But no, seriously, a lot of them don't have the answers. They're worried. They're worried about the people working from home. I have a very positive attitude on that. I think the people working from home can't wait to get out. Now, maybe again,
Sure.
not as often. So
Right.
what you have to do is gear your business to making the most, perhaps, of maybe fewer visits. I don't know about. On the other hand, I have been just because I've been very careful for the last since the COVID rate went up the last few weeks, I've stayed home completely. I was going into the office 2 or 3 days a week before that, and today I had a doctor's appointment this morning, and I walked home and I went shopping. I went into Butterfield Market and bought myself some tuna fish for lunch. It was the most exhilarating experience I've had in a long time.
It was a thrill,
Yes,
right? I
the
mean,
people,
yes.
they're looking at the windows,
Oh.
looking at the products. And so I
Yeah.
think people are starved for that. I also think that, contrary to a lot of people with telling about everyone's leaving, the sales are starting to go up in the cooperative apartments again. People are realizing what they're missing. Maybe I've lived my whole life in the city, and I believe in New York City. I believe that I part of our success, I think, in the Design Center is I believe that the New York Design Center is really an institution. And because it started in 1891, and because we're still here, because some of the same families that built the building own the building, I think all of that is so important. And that's the fiber and fabric of a city. I think when the theaters come back, that's going to be a big boost. You look at the outdoors of the restaurants. I haven't eaten anywhere, but I look and watch
Well,
people.
exactly. I was thinking just keeping you indoors was probably enough to close several restaurants around 32nd Street. So I mean, just you not showing up was, I mean, there were maitre d's who were thinking they're looking in the wanted ads because they don't see Jim Druckman. So I mean, but I completely agree. And interestingly, and we've talked about sort of keeping things interesting. I think there's such an opportunity for design centers to take advantage of the fact that people can't wait to get back to great experiences and retail. Some of the great retail stores, look at what they did in the past. I mean, there's a reason why Gary Friedman's putting all those restaurants and all the cappuccino and wine bars in there, because he knows that draws people. And I think there are so many opportunities for showrooms to think about what can they do to entice people to come back when people are ready, and people are going to be ready. One day I'm going to buy a monthly pass again for Metro North, and I'm going to get on that train that I haven't been on in almost a year, and I can't wait to get back to the city and do all sorts of things. And so many other people feel the same way. I see every day on Instagram designers are talking about, oh, I'm so glad to be back in a design center and shopping again.
No, I
I
think it's
mean,
true. We've been very, very careful to promote a safe environment at 200 Lex. We do everything by appointment. We check their temperatures. We only allow two people in an elevator, one person in a bathroom. We insist that everybody's masked. I tell them, if I see anybody without a mask, it's like no light bulb. Seriously, I almost threw three people out the last time I was there. Because we want to provide even now a safe environment. So we get up to 100 designers a day coming in and shopping, which is not shabby in the middle of COVID.
How are you thinking these days? I've heard a rumor, Jim, and you tell me if this is true. I've heard there are other design centers in New York City as well. Have you heard that? Have you heard there are other buildings?
There
I don't want to name names
are.
or
We
mention.
yes, of course, there are other designs. We're big enough in New York, if you think about it, unlike some of the other cities. We I don't know how many square feet are in the A and D building that devoted to design, because it's also offices. But
Right.
there's over 1 million square feet of design showrooms in New York City. And that doesn't include the independent locations in the contract area, like Steelcase or Hayworth those large companies. And I think that New York has been capable of supporting us all very nicely. We don't necessarily have the same marketing strategies. But they exist.
Yeah. Well, I think back to years ago when you wanted the design buildings to all participate in things together.
Right? I certainly did.
And that was a big disappointment for you that didn't happen. That a real sort of design week with the design buildings all coming together.
You have a good memory, Dennis. I haven't spoken about that for a long time. I'm impressed.
Well, I remember you and I.
I wanted to have buses going up and down. I wanted to have all the lampposts with designs.
Yes.
I wanted to have Soho involved. I wanted to have Tribeca. Everywhere that there was anything to do with design, I thought we should have a design week. And they're trying. I mean, the city is trying with Design NYC. Is that? I mean, we're charter members. Alex has been on their board since they started. But mine was a little different. My idea was a bit different than that. They're a little more corporate. I was just fun and design. And I was going to get Cooper Hewitt to be involved, Museum of the City of New York to be. I had the whole plan, but we couldn't do it ourselves,
right.
And everybody had a different philosophy. I'm not saying they were right or wrong. That was just my philosophy.
Tell me, we touched earlier on the Brunswick story, and I know that for you. Fabric has always been on your wish list, right? And
correct.
And tell me where you are in your hunt for.
Well, we have started attracting more fabric people, perennials, Pendler. I'm negotiating with two others, one other at the moment that I can't say. And I think that the industry has changed. It used to really be you couldn't deny it and still maintain a reputation for honesty. Fabric was really led the industry for years and years and years. And I think it's less so now. It's a necessary product. It helps direct the design, but because you have fewer large companies that have either they've consolidated, as Kravitz done, or it seems to be less. I shouldn't say exciting because they have some exciting new things in their lines, but it's less imperative. The furniture has become. Let's put it the other way around. Furniture has become more important than it was. We're slowly getting more fabric people. They realize that design, you know, the only people for years was Kravitz, who've had a showroom in the building for years. And so anytime somebody is buying a sofa in one of the other 100 showrooms, they get to go down to Kravitz easily, and especially with Kravitz's new concept, which is fantastic. And they can access Kravitz, they can access Brunswick, Lee Jofa, was it Baker? Is that the English company?
Yes, and now they've got
Dongia now.
So it's all
there. It's all available, and they're very smart because they were by themselves for all these years.
Well, and that's what I was always trying to figure out. And the other building that's in the high 50s up on the east side, they seem to have such a stranglehold on all the fabric lines, and that seemed to be this tough nut
to
crack.
I had a teacher in high school who taught history. He would always start about colonization and migration by saying, the first thing you must know is that dukes don't migrate. And all of these companies have been eminently successful where they are now, and many of them are loath to take a risk and go somewhere else. And you can't say as you blame them. That's been, so that's why I stopped just grasping for fabric and decided I was going to be the best furniture building in the United States, which I think we are. And you know, I'm not a bragger or anything, but I do think now the mix of furniture in the New York Design Center, with the support of fabric and the support of rugs and the support of antiques, makes us the best spot to buy furniture in America. But I could be prejudiced.
Well, so if fabric is not less important, but if it's not seemingly as urgent for you these days, and as you say, you're continuing to make headway there.
Oh, but I do want them. I mean, if anyone's listening out there and you sell fabric, come on down.
Call Jim Druckmann at 1-800 New York Design Center. I wonder as you think about the next 95 years for the New York Design Center, what you think needs to happen in terms of the progression of the building, in terms of the progression of the industry. What
can you give me a shorter time span?
let's take the next 50 years of your life, Jim. Over the next for you. I mean, really though, as you think about sort of what there is to be done and what's going to meaningfully move the industry forward and move the building forward, what sort of comes to mind for you?
I think we have to continue to work in tandem with designers and design schools to enhance the image of interior design. The key is that we have to establish ourselves one way or the other. And I don't necessarily mean New York Design Center. I mean design centers in general as the number one, the arbiters of taste that we are or should be. Number two, as a place that where you want to learn about good design, you can find out about it, and support the creation of some kind of marketing initiatives. Can't do it ourselves. Can't, even if the three in New York were together, they couldn't do it themselves. But we've got to educate people to the fact that there is a great value to great design. And this is how you learn. This is how you see it. This is how you feel it. This is how you sit on it. And if I knew exactly what to do, I would do it now. But I don't. I think we're always edging towards more education, more involvement. I have to say, and I don't like to criticize anybody, I think the ASID, which is the only really strong national design organization, has to take a more active role in promoting the industry. I think that they collect a lot of money in dues. They have it, I think, but I'm not sure that they have been properly directed to support the success of their membership and the success of the industry. And you need in this day and age when everything is masked, another secret to the genius at RH. They're everywhere. They're ubiquitous. And everybody used to sort of snicker with those catalogs that came all the time. Fabulous marketing. Fabulous marketing. The design industry, which is so fragmented, has to have an organization that properly supports the education of the public to the value of great design. I think that's the easiest way to say it. And we're here. I'm ready to take on any ideas to support
Gary
that.
Wheeler, new president of the ASID, call Jim Druckmann, and he's ready to talk about what needs to be done. I have talked about this many times. I mean, I think if the interior designers had more marketing support behind them and people understood the value, as you were talking about earlier, there are so many newly affluent people in this country.
Yes.
And unfortunately for many of them, they think that RH, to your point, is the top of the market. They think,
by the way, it's not necessarily unfortunate. They're very happy with, people are happy with it. They don't know that there's something else or another choice.
Yeah.
And the, you know, as I said, there's nothing wrong with RH's styling. It's just you're taking their styling because you feel comfortable, and if, as a customer, comfortable and confident. And that's what they've done so well. And interior designers, because there's no centralized form of marketing, have not done it as well. You know, they still, you know, the same conversations from when I started are still going on about the price transparency and the this and that. I've said for years, it's not the price. That's what everybody hangs their hat on to criticize the industry. I've never, I mean, yes, if some guys got, they used to have those codes that, you know, some guy got this price and somebody got that price, that's not good. But if it's one price and one discount for everybody, that's the price. I mean, I've never understood that's what everybody focuses on when they criticize the design industry. I think that the better criticism is that there are some designers and not as many, thank goodness, but there's some designers who really aren't that good, or at least if they are good, some of them maybe don't deliver what they say they're going to deliver or whatever it is. You know, I mean, that's an area maybe you could criticize, but mostly people are just scared. They're scared. They think it's expensive. They think it's they don't understand. And it's education. It's education that will enhance the industry. And who's going to be able to do that education? Yes, design centers to some small extent. Obviously, NYSID and the other Savannah and the other design schools, they can do it. But there still has to be a viable industry organization making a real effort. And now you've heard my soapbox speech about the AHRQ.
Well, and I'm
in as kind a way as I can say.
No, and I completely understand, and I do think that is the opportunity. You're on the board at the New York School of Interior Design. You're the president of Kips Bay. I mean, you're certainly showing different ways that one could be connecting with the industry.
Kips Bay, now that we're national as opposed to just local, is really enhancing people's view and knowledge of good design. We had, in the middle of COVID, if you would believe, we had a show house in Dallas, Texas, and we had 8,500 people attend, and all done carefully with COVID restrictions. And so we do Florida, we do now Dallas, New York. We're trying to bring great design around to the country. But again, we're a charity. We've got to support 10,000 children every year. And so, our resources are also limited. But a national organization like the ASID should have been able to generate the resources for this.
I completely agree. Jim, I can't thank you enough for making the time to talk with us.
Oh, I had a good time. I hope I didn't talk either too much or be too pedantic. That's what I'm always afraid
of.
No,
it was great, and I really appreciate it, and I always love the opportunity. So thank you.
Well, I always love the opportunity of talking with you. We don't have to, be on TV.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to keep up with the latest industry news, visit us online at businessofhome.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, browse job postings, or join our BOH Insider membership community for access to exclusive online educational workshops, a free print subscription, a private Facebook group, and more. If you have a note for the podcast, drop us a line at podcast@businessofhome.com. This show was produced by Fred Nikolaus and edited by Albert Burge for Podfly. I'm Dennis Scully. Thanks again for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and I'll see you next week.